I'm happy that I have the privilege of introducing our speaker this morning. She speaks at a lot of AA and Al-Anon conferences and conventions, and I'm sure that she has heard many things when she is being introduced, probably many varied and interesting introductions. I doubt that I could come up with anything very novel or unique to say about our speaker this morning, so as our program tells me, I'm going to keep it simple. I would like to say that Blanche and I have been friends for many years, even though we have just had a face-to-face encounter this weekend. You see, she has been a frequent contributor to the Al-Anon Forum. For those of you who may not know, that's our Al-Anon monthly magazine. It's the voice of our fellowship. And every time I would pick up a form over the past 11 years, and there would be an article or a letter with the signature Blanche D. Odessa, Texas, I would zone in on it immediately, because this lady had a way of always, it was kind of uncanny, a way of always addressing my need at the moment. She had the right thing to say to me at the right time. I do say that she has had a tremendous impact on my Al-Anon program by what she has written. I like to say that we've been communicating. She's been writing and I've been reading. I know all of you are just as anxious as I am to hear her story of recovery this morning. So I am at this time going to ask all of you to help me extend a warm and loving West Virginia welcome to Blanche D., now of Austin, Texas.
My name is Blanche, and I am a recovering Al-Anon. Hi. And I have been a member of the Al-Anon family groups since July of 1964. And when I tell you that, I'm telling you that I came into Al-Anon in Texas, because we give dates in Texas. And I have learned to do what makes me comfortable when I'm away from home, and that does. I'm glad to be back in West Virginia. I think it was in 1976. That I was invited to talk at Jackson's Mill. I'm a little embarrassed. There are people who think that I'm reasonably bright and reasonably well organized and sometimes efficient, and you're the only ones who know the terrible truth. At Jackson's Mill, I didn't connect the name Jackson with the Jackson, and I thought the painting behind me at the podium was of General Grant, and I made quite a few remarks about that. Clancy, who spoke after I did, said it was a good thing I didn't teach history. And then when I started to come see you this time, I didn't look at my ticket, and my travel agent gave me a ticket to Charleston, South Carolina. And Alice spent some time on the phone trying to run me down to tell me I was coming into the wrong place. There's something about West Virginia that just turns me into a bubble-headed blonde. I don't know what it is. But if you'll keep it quiet, maybe it won't get noised around everywhere else. I also want to say happy 31st to AA and Al-Anon here in West Virginia. That's really 62 years, you know, 31 for the alcoholics and 31 for the families, right? I think it's so important to stop and say hooray when we've made another year of whatever. For the last few years, when I'm allowed to share Al-Anon in different places, I have been trying to be open and vulnerable and take all the risks that that implies and speak to you from my heart and not my head, because I have learned that what reaches your heart has to come from mine. And that was not easy for me the first few years. It was much easier for me to lecture, you know. You hear that every now and then. It was easier to talk about the program than about me. It was easier to tell you what I thought than how I felt. And that isn't what it's all about. That isn't what sharing is about. And that isn't what I want to do this morning. So I will need you to listen with your hearts as I try to talk to you from mine. And I will need you loving me back. A great many of you say that you have heard my story, and Lord knows some of you have so many times, or a tape, And you could just have slept late this morning, because I have only one story, and I'm not going out and do it over again just so I'll have something different to tell you. So you're just going to have to hear the same one, if ever they are the same. Because whenever it was that we were last together, you and I, we meet at a different place in our spiritual journey this morning. I have done a great deal of learning and hurting and growing and laughing and loving the last few years, and I dare say you have too, because that's what it's about. And so maybe we can share our mutual growth this morning. I hope so. I came into Al-Anon kicking, screaming, clutching my halo, protesting to everybody who would listen that I was fine, thank you. I had not done the drinking, and I did not need the therapy, and leave me alone. Now, I wasn't quite that abrupt, but just nearly. And I have been grateful every day for these nearly 19 years that God led me to a group of people who were serious about recovery, who were practicing the principles. And what I know of Al-Anon principles this morning, I know because they were practiced lovingly and tenderly on me at a time when I was anything but lovable, when I was condescending and patronizing and bitchy, and I don't know how they did it, but they loved me anyway. And that's how I learned to love for free, not from what anybody said, but because I was loved for free and unconditionally. I was tolerated when my behavior was well nigh intolerable. And I have to remember that when I'm working with people that I find hard to love, which happens. I found out that Al-Anon is not a ladies' auxiliary. It does not exist to bake cookies. That it is not a coffee klatch or a sewing circle. And these were people who were sick and tired of being sick and tired and ready to get well. In fact, I like to stop here in my story and clear up several misconceptions that I find to be pretty rampant everywhere. See, I used to say along about here that I was a typical Al-Anon. I thought everyone came in angrily and reluctantly. That's not so. A lot of people come in knowing they need help. They're way ahead of where I was. I lost several years before I decided that I needed some help. And so I don't use the term typical Al-Anon anymore. It means different things to different people. There is a rumor, you know, that all alcoholics are either beautiful or handsome, talented, intelligent, charming, sensitive, and sexy. Have you heard that one? I never get an argument about that when I say that. But the other side of that coin is that they're inevitably married to dull, mousy people. And if you think that's a typical Al-Anon, you can forget it. And another myth I like to dispel. There are those who feel that during the drinking years, the non-alcoholic sat home knitting, you know, Priscilla Pureheart, or Peter Pureheart, while the alcoholic was doing his thing. Some of us did, but some of us did everything the alcoholic did, and we did them cold sober. So let's don't have any illusions about each other this morning. I also like to talk about the definition of an Al-Anon because, and you may not have this problem up here, but in Texas, there are people in AA who seem to feel that any member of their family is an Al-Anon by virtue of their being in AA. So for the record, an Al-Anon is a member of an Al-Anon family group who attends meetings regularly and who works the Al-Anon program. If you hear, you do have that up here, uh-huh. If you hear anyone else talking about Al-Anon, don't listen, because that person may be well-intentioned, but he or she is uninformed. That person is not sharing the message. He's spreading the disease, and you don't need to listen. I guess I'm trying to say that Al-Anon is not a group of AA groupies, okay, but not a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism. And I had to learn that. I had to learn that it was for me and for my recovery, that it doesn't promise to save marriages, only sanity. And above all, I learned that happily ever after means my personal recovery. In 1965, my mother died. She was 58, which is not young, but it's young to die. And I thought I could not stand it because she was my best friend. I was visiting the hospital there toward the end, and I stepped out of her room and into the hall because I was crying. A woman in the room across the hall, whom I have never seen before or since, beckoned me into her room, and when I stepped in, she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." I said, "You don't understand. Her illness is terminal." And she said, "I didn't say she's going to get well. I said she's going to be all right." And my mother did not get well, and she has been all right ever since. That's the best way I know to tell you what I heard when I got to you. It's as if I said to you, "My husband is barely sober." And you had said, "We didn't promise you a sober husband. You're going to be all right." Or if I had said to you, "I have a very sick, fragile marriage." You would have said, "We didn't promise to save your marriage, but you're going to be all right." And I have been. And better than that, I know I will be. Our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. I very much want to save some time to talk about what I'm like now, because I agree with Father Martin, who says that when he is sitting out there and you're up here at the podium, he says, "You are playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you got without telling me how well you've gotten." And I would be lying if I, out of some false humility, told you I have no recovery, because through the grace of God I have a great deal. And that's what I want to share with you. I was born and grew up in Florida, lived in Jacksonville until I was 10, and then in Pensacola until I married. I grew up during the Depression. And my father was a charming, intelligent, talented, sensitive alcoholic. He was a violent alcoholic, and I was a battered child. I didn't know that for a long time, and it was years before I could say it from behind a podium. I think so many problems are not uncommon in alcoholic homes that need to be discussed and talked about. We were poor, and when I say that, I don't mean we didn't have luxuries. I mean there was not enough to eat, and there was not enough to wear, and there was insufficient shelter. And the area of town where we lived was slightly above a slum. And I have to tell you that because even so, the children in that neighborhood were not allowed to play with me. I know now it's because their parents were understandably apprehensive about what went on at our house. But I did not know that then. And I felt rejection and rage. And without actually verbalizing it in my mind, I know now that I thought, "I'll get back at them some way, somehow." And as it happened, the way I could do it was in school. I could beat the socks off of them there, and I did, and I loved it. And that became my way up and out, and was far too important to me. I guess it was along about then, I must have been 7 or 8 years old, that I bought into a set of rules. These are man-made social rules that I lived by until I got to you and you taught me about spiritual laws. But these man-made rules assured that even if you didn't like me, you would, by golly, respect me. And people did. And I saw to it that they did. I did the right thing, and if I didn't know what it was, I found out. And this was the only way I felt secure and safe. My parents were divorced when I was 8, and when I was 10, my mother remarried. She married a very kind man, a man who happened not to drink at all. We were never close, but we felt genuine affection for each other. The finances were slightly better. There was then sufficient money for the necessities, but college was not considered a necessity. And I was the first person in my family who wanted to go away to school. The thinking was, well, all right, if that's what you want, and if you can find some way to pay for it. And there's never been anything wrong with my taste. I chose a very expensive and very fine university that happens to be in Texas, Baylor University. And so that's how I got to Texas. I went out there to go to school. My mother said it was all right with her if I wanted to go to school in Texas, but she said, "Make up your mind that you'll spend the rest of your life out there, because you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant." I said I was going to do no such thing, but I did, and they don't, and I have. And so she was right about that, as she was everything else. Texas, as most of you know, is a state of mind. And I have been very happy there. I cannot imagine living anywhere else. But I get very homesick for the white sand and the blue water of Florida, and I make it back every year. I have a peasant's need to touch base with my roots. You know, I have an emotional need to go back to my beginnings, and I've learned to take care of myself, and I do that. My father-in-law was a very ardent Texan. I don't know any other kind, and he used to say that he taught his children never to ask a man where he's from, because he said, if a man's from Texas, he'll tell you, and if he's not, it's not nice to embarrass him. I think now that it was inevitable that I marry an alcoholic. It is my belief that no one comes untreated out of an alcoholic home and makes a healthy marriage. But I will tell you that I never dated anyone who drank, and that was not self-righteousness, that was fear. I had had drinking, thank you. And Charles did not drink at all when we married. You told me later that drinking is only a symptom of the illness, and it's as if he had had tuberculosis, but he had not yet started hemorrhaging. And of course I found myself an alcoholic. That's the person I felt comfortable with and understood and knew. Our Al-Anon literature doesn't leave us any way to cop out of our responsibility in this. We are told that healthy, stable, well-adjusted people are not attracted to alcoholics, that we have matching illnesses. I'm translating loosely. But a direct quote is that we were immaturity calling to immaturity. And I know now that I had an obsessive need to be needed. You see, that's how I got my feeling of self-worth. And of course I found someone who would regularly be dependent and would need me. I think that had to happen. Sick people marry sick people, and they rear sick children, and don't let anyone tell you anything different. For many years, I taught those children. In California, in talking about this, the Al-Anons say every pot finds a lid that will fit it. And in Colorado, they say the horns on the head of the alcoholic just fit the holes in ours. So I think it's rather universally accepted that we found each other because we had matching neuroses. And I am so grateful that our fellowship offers therapy for the whole family, because Lord knows it is a family illness. During the drinking years, and let me say that we were blindsided by alcoholism. I didn't see it coming. My husband went from not drinking at all to blackouts in 5 or 6 years. And I thought because he didn't drink the way my father did. He didn't drink in the mornings and he was never violent. But of course he could not be an alcoholic. I thought he was mentally ill, but I didn't think he was an alcoholic. I had slogans I lived by during those years before you gave me some others to live by. One of them was, what will people think? Did you have that one? And I lived by, don't rock the boat. If he's drunk, he can't hear you, and if he's sober, for heaven's sake, don't say anything, you know. And one day I just swore by, it's not that bad yet. That was a slogan that I really lived by. And we played games, especially silent treatments. We played one, guess what I'm mad about? Did you ever play that one? Charles used to say that I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. Wasn't true, of course. I did all the wrong things during the drinking years. Everything that I learned later in Al-Anon is not the thing to do. I did give silent treatments, and I had tantrums, and I threatened, and I raved, and I ranted, and I sulked, and of course it was pointless. But you see, I had never run across anything in my life that I couldn't control. And I had never failed at anything. And I was about to fail at a marriage, and it was killing me. And so I lied, and I protected him. He was almost literally loved to death. And that can happen. I played Let's Pretend as obsessively as he drank. Let's pretend we're a normal family. Let's pretend that nothing is wrong. I would like for you to think that I stayed with him out of love and loyalty. I did not. I stayed with him out of pride. And you're close enough to the Deep South that I'll only have to touch on this because it was part of my upbringing. I don't know how it is now down there on the Georgia-Alabama border. But when I was growing up, Southern girls were given a very specific kind of upbringing. We were expected to flutter our eyelashes and flash our dimples and swish our skirts, but it was understood that we were made of stainless steel and we could cope. And one did not air one's dirty linen in public. And if you lived with a man, you didn't criticize him to other people. And this was the way I was brought up, and I couldn't bear for anyone to think that I was a failure at my marriage, and that's what I thought it would have been. You see, I was still keeping those rules. And the rules said, that's the way you behaved. I thought the answer was to try harder. That had worked in everything else in my life. I think the greatest philosophy published in America today is in the Peanuts cartoon strip. And there's one when Charlie Brown is helping his little sister Sally with her long division. She says, how many times will 24 go into 12? And he says, 24 won't go into 12. And she says, it will if you push. That was my attitude. It will if you push, and I was going to try harder. I had absolutely no understanding of or tolerance for people who messed up their lives. You see, my thinking was that I had as inauspicious a beginning as anybody I ever knew, and I had obtained a fine education at a very fine university and paid for it myself. I had married the man I wanted, and he was and is brilliant and handsome and can be charming. And I had the children I wanted when I wanted them. And I did work that I loved. And what in the world was wrong with anyone else? Especially this man, because you see, I married considerably above myself. Now, he used to say I shouldn't say that. I don't know any other way to say it. This little girl who wasn't good enough for the neighborhood children to play with, and I married a man from a very fine old family. At one time, they'd had a great deal of money, and they still had a great deal of prestige, and I liked that. And I needed that. But I thought, how could anyone born with everything going for him mess up his life like this? I had to learn later, when you told me, that he wasn't that way by choice. But I think that is not an uncommon attitude, and I tried to remember to mention it. I had been religious all my life, and I didn't yet know about being spiritual. Now, don't misunderstand me. I know people who are both. And I know people who are neither and either. But I was in the church every time the doors opened for very many years. And that still works for a great many people. And you won't hear any criticism of it from me. But when I got to you and you explained to me the difference in being religious and spiritual, I knew what had been missing all of those years. And yet, even during the sickest time, I did a few things right. You know, I used to say by accident, I know now by the grace of God, without knowing it. For instance, I never thought of him as a drunk, and I never referred to him as a drunk. I was married to a very fine man who drank too much, who had what my Irish grandmother called the failing. And I didn't criticize him to our children. So that later when he was able to reach out tentatively to them in love, they were able to respond. Once he was sober, I could gripe all I wanted to. But I'm glad that during those years, I did not do that. And I had a God whom I worshiped, who had meaning for me at that point in my life, and was my handhold on sanity for a very long time. Not God as I understand him this morning. But I hope that God, as I understand him today, is not the same as he will be in another 19 years either. I have great faith that I will progress spiritually too. And I had during those years a doctor, our family physician, who was Al-Anon before I found Al-Anon. And I say that because he said, you must do what is necessary for your sanity and your serenity regardless. And I needed permission. He said the magic word. He said, your children need one stable parent. Well, if you said need to me, I was putty in your hands, you know. So I was able to do some things that kept me going because he said I should. The year before we got to you people, the same doctor suggested that I return to teaching. And I had taught school before my children were born, but see, the rules said that no good mother worked outside her home. I thought that was graven in stone somewhere. And of course I was going to keep the rules. And he said, I think it will be good for you. And I'm not a spontaneous person. I'm trying to learn to be, but I'm not. And I thought about it for a year before I went back to teaching. My children were 9 and 10, I guess, at that time. I know they were in school the same hours that I was. And for the following 19 years, I taught high school English. The last 10 of them at a very large, very fine, very affluent high school. I have to mention that because it's an important part of my life. It was a role that I filled that I found enriching and meaningful. It also gives me a chance to say that I don't want to hear you criticize kids to me. I try to say this lovingly and gently, but I think I know more of them than you do. I've accumulated several thousand. And because I taught them communication, I think I got to know them better. Once they trusted me, they would write or tell things that they felt and thought. And I got to know them better than I think perhaps a math teacher or a science teacher would. I lived in a town, Odessa has 120,000 people. And I don't know how to describe it to you, a great deal of money. We had still have a Rolls-Royce dealership that could not keep cars in the showroom in a town that size. And yet the cultural event of the year was a cow chip throwing contest. And football was second only to oxygen in importance. I mustn't spend too much time talking about the kids, but I will say that it wasn't one long honeymoon. I usually say that there were days when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not always. And they were a tremendous enrichment in my life. What happened was that Charles never quit trying to find an answer. He went to lay counselors and ministers, to medical doctors, and he went through clinics. And many of you know that 20 years ago, you couldn't be hospitalized for alcoholism. Your doctor had to lie if he put you in a hospital. Charles drank at home. He didn't want to associate with those people in those bars. And he says when he talks that the way you create a real crop of Alateens and Al-Anons is to drink at home. He managed to escape the hospitals and the jails because, as he says, you don't get arrested driving a sofa. I don't know that there are advantages to any kind of drinking. That just happened to be his pattern. But he really did try to find help, and it wasn't available as it is now. Finally, a business acquaintance of his sent him to talk to a counselor, a woman who had her doctorate in psychology and was doing family counseling in Odessa at that time. Strange lady, very eccentric. It'll tell you something about her when I tell you that his appointment was at 12:30 a.m. And something about him when I tell you he kept it. He was there. And he'd been seeing her for about 6 weeks when she called me, and it was January of 1964. I was still home from school for the Christmas holidays. There are times in our lives, there are memories, I think, that are indelibly imprinted. They are moments of such clarity. They are such lucid, sane moments in our lives. And this is one of them. I remember every detail of the room where I was standing. I remember everything about it. She told me her name, and of course I recognized it, and she said, "Your husband is an alcoholic, and this is a family illness, and I need to talk to you too." And all of my Deep South upbringing went out the window, and I said, "You're out of your mind," and hung up. Now, that isn't the way I was brought up. You see, if you don't like somebody, you are kind but cool. But the phone rang again before I could leave the room. And she said, when I said hello, she said, "Hey, don't hang up. I know what you've been through." Well, she couldn't know because I hadn't told anybody. And I stood there with that phone in my hand, and I cried and I cried and I cried. I had not cried for a long time. I guess that was one of the first freedoms you gave me, was that I cry any time I please now. Charles used to say I could cry reading a menu or a telephone directory. Not quite. But I cry at parades, and I cried at school at the pep rallies, and that's all right. I did go to talk to her, and it was she who sent us to AA and Al-Anon. For 6 months after that January, I would attend only open meetings, and if anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I was kind but cool. And I explained that I had not done the drinking and I did not need the therapy, thank you. I had coped very well, if you didn't believe it, ask anybody. And in July of that year, we went to San Antonio, where we had lived for 4 years and where our children were born, a beautiful city. We went to celebrate the 4th of July weekend with friends who still lived there. And Charles got drunk and he says, "I must never say it was a slip, but I must always tell you it was a carefully planned drunk. I know that it was not the worst one or the longest one, and I wasn't at all surprised. I didn't expect him to quit drinking." We were driving home and he said, "I'm going to have to tell my group about this because I'm due to get a 6-month chip next week. Do your groups give some memento of sobriety? You know what I'm talking about." And in my absolute appalling ignorance, I said, "I won't tell anybody." And that's when he explained to me that that isn't what it's all about. This got my attention, I have to tell you that, because we've been married 14 years at that time, and this man had never said to me, "I'm sorry, I was wrong, I made a mistake." And he was going to go down there and say it to some people he'd known 6 months, and that made me mad. So I went to take another look at him. And I used to get this far in my story, and I would say, "And I don't know why the invitation of a particular woman who invited me to Al-Anon reached me when no one else's invitation had. But I have done 3, I think, very thorough and comprehensive 4th and 5th steps over the years. And with the very first one I did, God revealed to me why her invitation reached me. And rigorous honesty requires that I tell you, and I really don't want to. This was a woman that I thought was as good as I was." Okay? I'm sorry, that's the way it was. She was the wife of a prominent local physician, and she had money and education and prestige and status and social standing and all the things I considered important. She still has all the things I consider important, but it's quite a different list today. And she became my first sponsor, and for 11 years, until she moved away, she was my sponsor. We have an Al-Anon booklet, Living with Sobriety, that says, while sobriety can be a welcome miracle, it does not guarantee happiness. And Charles and I had a very stormy and very difficult sobriety. I believe I'm quoting the AA literature right when it says, "We consider that man unthinking who says that sobriety is enough. It is essential, but it is not enough. The first 18 months we were with you were unmitigated hell. They were worse than anything we'd ever had drinking, because Charles was stark, raving sober and very much aware of all of my defects of character and no longer held back by guilt from mentioning them loudly and clearly and frequently. Clancy says that when the alcohol is gone, the ism remains. And that's what we have to live with. You see, if you're married to an alcoholic, you can blame any problem you have on it. He's a marvelous whipping boy, a great scapegoat. I could have said during the drinking years, "Well, yes, I have a bad temper, but if you knew how I suffer." I think martyrdom is a symptom of untreated Al-Anonism. I practically required plastic surgery to remove my hand from my forehead when I got to you. I had suffered so nobly. I think during those years, we tend to feel that if he, she did not drink, then that person would be the husband, wife, daughter, son, mother, father of our dreams. I always thought if Charles didn't drink, he would remember birthdays, anniversaries, Valentine's. Of course he would. Sober, he didn't remember birthdays, anniversaries. That's not so important, but the point I'm making is, I know now that when an alcoholic is sober, he has to become the person he is. And when Charles became the person he was somebody that I did not know. And when I work with new Al-Anons now, I run across this all the time. A young woman a few years ago who felt sure that when her mother sobered up, her mother would be in the kitchen in a fluffy apron making cookies. Listen, that lady was no fluffy apron type, I tell you. And this girl had to learn that her mother became the person that she is. We hang on to these illusions, and we are as obsessed with those as the alcoholic ever was with drinking. This fantasy, this overlay of fantasy, is so difficult to give up. Quoting Bill Wilson again, we are like men who have lost their legs. We do not acquire new ones. So Charles became the person that he was, and I got to Al-Anon in pretty bad shape without knowing it. But one thing, I had no way of expressing a need. I told you I didn't rock the boat. And when you told me that no one should have to read my mind, I realized that no one ever had, but I had thought, as so many people do, that if you have to ask for something, it's no good. And so I learned to ask, and I learned that I am responsible for seeing that my needs are met. No one else on earth is responsible for that. And I heard that as kind of a burden, and it has become a great freedom to me. And I'm able to tell people today, I need a hug. I need some affirmation. I need to be by myself. And no one has cut me out of his life because of that. Wow, what a freedom. Sometimes I'm just overwhelmed when I talk about it and I realize it. I came in emotionally frozen. I think most of us do. I didn't think this consciously during the drinking, but at some level I seemed to feel that feelings had valves, and I could turn off the one marked anger or self-pity or resentment. And you told me, no, there's one valve, and it's marked feelings. And if you turn it off, you turn them all off. And I was emotionally so frozen. And you literally loved me back to life. And you know how painful it is when the feeling comes back after you've been frozen somewhere. And for many years, I would feel new pain in a new place, and it would be some little frozen pocket that had not yet thawed. It's been a number of years since I felt that kind of pain. I had a wall that I hid behind, and I think this is common to an untreated Al-Anonism. Now, a lot of people think of a wall as being something that causes you to be quiet and withdrawn. Not necessarily. I didn't react that way. My reaction to the drinking was to join everything in town and to run most of them. I was very angry when I'd been in Al-Anon a few weeks and no one asked me to be president. They obviously didn't know who I was. I want you to know that's the kind of Al-Anon that God keeps sending me now. I want you to know that. I keep telling him I have the message. But the barrenness of busyness can be a wall. Mindless laughter can be a wall. Compulsive talking can be a wall. We don't get to know people like that. And God knows they never let us, you know, get to know us. And so I was certainly hiding behind a great many defenses. And my group wisely did not try to batter them down. You know, I used to do that when I thought people were hiding behind walls. I wanted to batter on them and say, let me in, I want to be your friend. I don't do that anymore. If you have a wall, you need it, and I will respect it. I do think that we can do for new people what was done for me. If the person looks out, you know, from the chink in the armor, we can let him know that the natives are friendly. And perhaps if we are warm and loving enough, the bricks in this wall will melt, as they certainly did for me. And I began to hear the basic teachings of Al-Anon, not all at once and not from just one person, but I had a gentle but firm sponsor who was a black belt Al-Anon, and she saw to it that I got the basics as fast as I could absorb them. I first heard, do you realize you're sick? Because if you don't think you're sick, you won't inconvenience yourself to get well. And they said, it's going to be inconvenient to do the things we're going to tell you to do. It was a while before I would admit to that, that yes, perhaps I needed some help. And then the next question was, do you want to get well? Even in Scripture, no one could be healed who did not want to get well. Maybe you need your neurosis. I had to look very hard at that one. And I decided I didn't want it anymore. And I would go to any lengths for recovery. And if I had known then to what lengths I might have to go, I don't know that I could have made that resolution. They said to me, if you both had cancer, you would go for treatment, whether he did or not, and whether he liked it or not. And so I went for treatment. Now, I will say in Charles' defense that Texas has no stronger advocate of Alateen and Al-Anon than he is. I would like to think that I would have done in Al-Anon and for Al-Anon everything that I have, whether he liked it or not, but I will tell you that it was a great deal easier to do it with his support and his approval, and that was an area in which he did approve. They told me, we don't hear the answer until we've asked the question. And you know, if you know all the answers, you don't ask any questions. And I got to you knowing all the answers. And it was a long time before I could ask the questions. My sponsor, realizing this, said, You're going to have to give up your old ideas. God can only fill an empty vessel. She said, we cannot put new wine in old bottles. And I was going to open AA meetings, and I was hearing chapter 5 read. And over I heard this, that the old ideas have to go. The result is nil until we give them up. Mark Twain, in talking about his book Huckleberry Finn, says, it is better to follow a sound heart than a deformed conscience. Now, I don't think anyone set out to deform my conscience, but they did it as they did yours. And I'll just mention a few things that I had to unlearn before I could hear anything that you had to tell me. One of them, I bet you heard this too, was God helps those who help themselves. And he does not, you know. He helps those who ask. And at the times I have needed him most desperately, I could not have helped myself if my life had depended on it, and it very nearly did. And you told me God helps those who ask. And I was taught growing up, and I'll bet you were, that mature people stand on their own two feet. They don't ask for help. I sometimes think if I had broken my leg back then, I would have tried to set it myself. I was really convinced that asking for help was a sign of weakness. And you told me that babies are dependent and adolescents are independent, and mature people are interdependent. And there's a difference between acknowledging a need and having it met, and a sick kind of dependency. I know now that some pain is necessary for my spiritual education, but misery is optional, and I do not opt to be miserable anymore. I can tell you that I don't hurt very long now before I holler, ouch, and I holler for help, and I have never reached out my hand that there hasn't been a hand there. I was brought up that I should always put others first, weren't you? That it was selfish beyond belief if you ever put yourself first. And you told me you don't only have a right, but you have a responsibility to take care of yourself. And you know, for a long time when I heard that, I heard eat properly, get enough rest. And then I heard you saying, you must take care of yourself emotionally. And so I do what is best for me today. And my sponsor says to me regularly, ask yourself what is in your own best interest. And I have to do that. I'd have nothing to give you, for instance, if I came and I had not been taking care of myself. I'll tell you the extent to which I have recovered. I just spent 10 days in New York City going to plays and museums and restaurants and having a marvelous time. That was a gift I might not have been able to give myself even a few years ago. But I'm learning that I deserve it. Look, I'm not talking about me first. I'm talking about my turn. And I had to get healthy enough even to say that. I was taught that what you don't know won't hurt you. What I didn't know nearly killed 4 people. You know, what you don't know can kill you. So item by item by item, I began to unlearn things that well-meaning people had taught me. And when the vessel was empty enough, you began to fill it. I feel sorry for people who get to us and who settle for a spiritual band-aid. And as soon as the immediate pain is relieved, they're okay. Because I have been so greedy for everything you have in this program. I want more. And I keep digging deeper and deeper, and I believe it's just limitless in what it has to offer. And I will not settle for the crumbs that fall from the table, because I know that the banquet is spread on the top. I guess it's along about then that I realized there were spiritual laws that transcend the man-made laws, and that they are just as real and irrevocable as the law of gravity. If I jump out of a tall building, I go down and not up, and I have not broken the law of gravity. I have just illustrated that it works. Well, you told me that resentment would make me sick. If I insist on holding one, and mine are always justified, of course, and I get arthritis and I get migraine, then I realize that that's a spiritual law. And I have not broken that law. I have just illustrated that it works. And I found this to be true. The spiritual laws are much more exacting. It's harder for me to love unconditionally than to stay within the speed limit and not cheat on my income tax. And I learned that the worst immorality is judgment. And I no longer have to have an opinion about everything and everybody. Of course, I was told to release this man, to get off of his back and get out of his way and get to work on myself.
Turn tape over, please.
Of course, I was told to release this man, to get off of his back and get out of his way and get to work on myself. They said, if you don't like the warts, let go of the frog. Sometimes to this day, I have to withdraw a little emotionally before I can release. And sometimes I release with anger before I can with love. And everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it. But I am able to do it today. And I believe what you told me, that anything we lose by release was never ours to start with. And that if we release it and it comes back, then it's ours forever. And it helped me to let go of the people I loved when I realized that they had their own direct line to God. You see, I hadn't known that. I thought my husband and children had to come through me to get his will. And I was happy to tell them God's will for their lives. They never even had to ask. Gosh. Another symptom of untreated Al-Anonism, you know, is rush in and rescue. And finally, I'm able to listen to your feelings today without fixing you. Now, every cell of my being wants to fix you, but I know better today, and I can listen. When I got to you and you said we don't give advice, I used to think, what do we do? You know, how do you help each other? And I know what we do instead of giving advice. We help people see what their available options are. Because I don't always know what mine are, and that's the first thing my sponsor did for me. Let's look at your choices. What are they? What will be the result if you choose this one? Well, what about this one? And I thought back then that I had three options. I thought I could divorce this man, I could live with him while we both tried to recover in the fellowship, or I could have a close, warm, loving, communicative marriage. So I opted for number three, and unfortunately that was not one of my available options. And I kept myself miserable for a long time because of it. I know today that any time I am miserable, I have opted for something that is not an available option. And so I need for you to help me see what my choices are, and especially what they are not. That's perhaps what we do best for each other. I used to translate. Did you ever translate with your children? Now, honey, what your daddy meant was, well, I quit doing that. I figured they could slug it out the best they could, toe to toe. They could just manage. It's high time they learned to communicate. I don't have time to talk about the extra dimension of family life it gave us to have our children in the program too, because they were in Alateen for 10 years each. They came in when we had a preteen group, and they left reluctantly after they were 20. We realized that they were really a little too old for it anymore. You see, during those god-awful years, I had a choice. I could stay or not. Those kids had no choice. And because you gave them intensive care for 10 years, they're really fine today. There'll be a special place in heaven for Alateen sponsors. You pointed me to the source, and you said that I must quit looking to people for what only God could give. And because I learned early on that He is the source and people are the channels, I think I have quit making demands on people. It is not anyone's job to take care of me emotionally or financially or any other way. God does that. And He might choose one channel one time and one another. But it's a great freedom for me to remember where the power comes from. And that it doesn't generate within me, but sometimes if I surrender enough, it does come through me. And after I learned that I was responsible for my behavior, and I saw it as a freedom and not a condemnation. You said you must learn to respond rather than react. You see, I had been in emotional slavery. If Charles got angry, I got angry. If he got depressed, I got depressed. I thought that meant we were close. It was as if I woke up in the morning and said to him, good morning, how do I feel today? Because it depended entirely on him. And I was taught, no, you can get up in the morning and decide what sort of person you want to be that day and be it. And it doesn't depend on circumstances or events or people. Well, that's some kind of choice to have too. So slowly I learned to acknowledge feelings and report them and try to act on them appropriately, and take the risk that involves. I learned so much from you about love. that if it's ever conditional, if we ever say, I love you if, it isn't love. That respect perhaps has to be earned, but love is a gift. If God is love, and I believe that he is, and if we were made in his image, and I believe that we were, then we were built for loving. And anything else is like throwing sand in an engine. I was not meant to operate on anger and resentment and self-pity. And I thought, you know, I thought all this introspection and this self-examination would turn me into a moral hypochondriac, that I'd just be constantly hunting faults and defects. And instead, it's very much like driving a car, and you don't even realize you're listening to the motor unless you hear a knock. And then you realize that on some level you were listening. And I certainly don't walk the walk as well as I talk the talk. Of course I don't. And I don't talk the talk as much as I want to feel the feeling. But at least today, I am aware of it. I can hear myself when I'm managing and controlling. And I hear myself doing that regularly. At least it doesn't come out so automatically anymore that I don't even know that I'm doing it. And you told me, and this was a valuable lesson, that I would not always get love on my terms, and I had to learn to listen for it. My sponsor would say you would not feel unloved if you could listen for love and hear it the way people are able to say it. And so when my son was 15 and couldn't say I love you in words, he home one day threw down his books and said, I'm glad you're not just some dumb broad like most of the ding-a-ling women I see. I thought, he loves me. I could hear, I love you. When a student would say, I don't like English, but this is my favorite class, I could hear, I love you. Or here, I wrote these poems for you. When my daughter, who was a teenager along about then and could cook one thing, said, would you like spaghetti for supper? I could hear, I love you. When my husband said, don't drive your car till I have the brakes checked. Or best of all, when he said, haven't you lost a few more pounds? I could hear, I love you. And when I quit demanding it on my terms, I was inundated with it. Now, that coin has another side, too. We're not often allowed to show it on our terms. This son is 6'3". I think he's been that tall all his life. Surely not. But if I could, I would fold him up and get him in my lap and cuddle and coo, and he would just die. So along about the time he was 15, 16, I learned from you to tell him I love him in ways that he could accept and understand. At that age, it meant feeding him like stoking a furnace. Have you ever fed a teenage boy? Later on, it meant not saying, who was that phone call from? Who was that letter from? Later than that, it meant not saying, why did the girl answer when I called your apartment? And because I am able to love them in ways that they can accept, I think we have an enviably close relationship today. I've got to hurry. Of course, I didn't learn this program all at once. And I don't have it all. I learned it slowly and painfully, you know, incident by incident, one day at a time. I can tell it to you so much more quickly than I learned it. And I still have days when I ask, what program? God who? And when I do, I have people I can call, and I say that, and they tell me what program and God who. Usually in words I have given them, don't you hate that? When they say, well, as you told me, and I think, no, I don't need that. I find that I do not have to be perfect, that practice makes progress, not perfection. And I have learned that recovery, thank God, is progressive too, even as the illness. And I have to say that I am awed by the people who have been coming into Al-Anon, let's say, the last 10 years. You know, they hit this program running. And if you are new, let me point out to you that 19, 20 years ago, we learned slowly because we didn't have us. Make sense? When I got to Al-Anon, there was nobody that had 5, 10, 15, 20 years. My sponsor had been in 13 months. I thought she knew everything. We had one hardback book and about 20 pamphlets. Now we have 8 hardback books, counting the Alateen books, and well over 100 paper publications. And we have people with maturity in the program. And I have to say, too, that I believe that as long as we stay with this fellowship. We have to grow or I do not think we can stay in the same place. That means now that I live on the growing edge just as much as any newcomer. And what I am learning is just as new and frightening to me after 19 years as what you are learning after 6 months or 3 years or five. It may be at a different level, but trust me, there is no limit to what we need to learn spiritually. And so I still need a hand to hold while I look around corners. And as I said, there's never been an empty space when I reached out for a hand to hold. I am extremely, extremely grateful for that. These children are fine today, thank you, and I mean literally thank you, because you're the ones who didn't turn loose of them for 10 years. My daughter is 29. She has an exciting career. She's a journalist with United Press International, and she's in the Bureau in Little Rock, Arkansas. A few years ago, she was married to a handsome, blonde, bearded young man that we like very much. This is a girl who never gave us a moment's trouble, who was always everything we wanted a daughter to be. But because you taught her that she could be who she is, she said, when it came time for her wedding, there's no rule that says your attendant has to be a girl. And the person I love most in the world is my brother, and I'm going to ask him to be my attendant. When she did, he replied in his gentle way, "Well, okay, I've never been a bride's person before." The groom said, "Well, in that case, I'm really closer to my sister than I am my brother. And it will round out the wedding party if I ask her." So we had a best woman and a man of honor. The minister was a beautiful young woman who had attended Baylor with our daughter and then gone to Union Seminary in New York City. An absolutely gorgeous young girl, then about 25. And because my daughter is a writer and her husband is a writer, they wrote a very beautiful and moving ceremony. And I sat there and cried in the time-honored fashion of the mother of the bride, thinking sobriety made this possible. Remembering how those two young people, my son and daughter, squabbled growing up, reacting to the tension and the anger in our home. I used to think, when they grow up, they'll never speak to each other again. And I have two brothers that I love very much, and that broke my heart. But when she came time to get married, the one she loved most in the world was her brother. He's 28, and he is, as I said, tall and blonde and gorgeous, and I can say that because he looks like his father. He's a commercial photographer in Dallas. The people he meets, you know, we become friends with the people we meet, and he meets models. I spend a great deal of time with him at the Dallas airport because when I go somewhere to share Al-Anon, I often have several hours in the Dallas airport. So he comes out to see me, always bringing one of these gorgeous young things on his arm. You know, she'll weigh 36 pounds, dripping wet, and has legs up to her armpits. And I said, I have told him that if I want to feel inadequate, I can stay home and iron. You know, I don't have to look at these gorgeous. But after living below poverty level for a long time, he is becoming successful beyond anything I had thought might happen at this young age. And I am so enormously grateful for the two of them. Now, I'm going to have to tell you something that you're going to hear is bad news, and I hope you won't. Please hear this as what had to happen next for my recovery and for Charles's. I think you know that relationships like people sometimes die. And Charles and I really lost our marriage in 1977 for a number of reasons that it would not be at all appropriate for me to go into from the podium. But for the next 3 years, we really tried to breathe life back into it, and it was like giving artificial respiration to a corpse. It couldn't be done. We had married for the wrong reasons. We had nourished each other's neuroses through the years. We had nothing to go back to. Because people who love us always ask, I have taken to saying, he did not leave me for another woman, I did not throw him out for another man, and no, he did not resume drinking. The marriage died. And that happens sometimes. Our recovery had taken us down different roads and in different directions. And for reasons I don't understand, something toxic happens when we try to relate to each other that does not happen when we relate to other people. It had become a very destructive relationship, and we care too much for each other to let that happen. We reached the point where we couldn't gain any further recovery within the framework of a very sick relationship. And we had said we would go to any lengths for recovery. It was a marriage that I know now was damaged beyond repair, you know, sick beyond healing. So in April of 1980, we released each other with dignity and respect, we really did, to find new lives and new directions. Our divorce was final in August of 1980. We have tried to remain friendly, but I would be lying if I said we were friends, because friends share feelings, and friends joy in each other's presence, and if we could have done that, we could have stayed married. One can live with a friend. But I can tell you that there is no villain, no one is wearing a black hat, and there is no ugliness or animosity when we talk together. Now, lest you think this is a storybook divorce, I will tell you that I am enraged that this man is able with his new friends to do and be everything I always wanted him to do and be, everything I thought recovery would bring. It seems to me that they are getting effortlessly what I yearned for and waited for 30 years. I have said that to him, or I would not be saying it to you. And he says, I don't know why I can do that with them and not with you. He did say, I don't have 30 years accumulated guilt and garbage to take into new relationships. On my saner days now, I rejoice at this evidence of his recovery. But the rest of the time, I'm just mad as hell. And I would be lying if I pretended otherwise, that he was not able or willing to make these changes in time to save our marriage. You know, nobody wants divorce. Nobody marries planning to get divorced. I certainly plan for us to grow old together, to watch our grandchildren playing to put our teeth in the same glass on the nightstand. And I have been angry that it was necessary, that I didn't get my way. I didn't plan to be single in middle age. And yet I never felt more direct guidance than I felt over this. I was never more helpfully Al-Anon than when I said, I will go to any lengths for recovery. And I have had no second thoughts and no doubts. Our children have been mutually supportive. Thank God they have not had to take sides. The weekend that Charles moved out, our son flew out from Dallas to help his daddy move. And he would alternate moving something to his daddy's apartment and then sitting on the sofa and holding me while I cried, and then moving something else out for his daddy. 2 weeks after the divorce was final, it was our daughter who called me and said, I know today would have been your 30th anniversary. I have talked about this for 3 years, and this is the first time I have had trouble talking about it in a long time. It's because you're so warm and accepting, and I feel so safe with you. Frankly, I can't stand crying speakers. I always think it looks contrived. Ending a 30-year marriage is like an amputation. It's necessary for survival sometimes, but the agony is intense. And there's phantom pain where the relationship used to be, just as there is phantom pain where a limb used to be. You told me a long time ago that suffering should not be wasted. That when it happened, the tragedy was not that it happened, but that we let it be wasted, that we backed God into a corner and we said, why me? And so I remembered that, and I did what you told me. You said, instead, ask, what am I supposed to understand? So that's what I have been asking. And all of the answers aren't in yet. I'll share them with you as fast as I get them, but I do have a few. I am supposed to understand, for instance, that I don't have to know what the future holds because I know who holds the future. I'm supposed to understand that I'm a whole person with or without a man. That's a neat feeling, because any man in my life now is there because I want him and not that I have a sick need. It has to be easier on him too. And I understand that God and I are enough, because you told me a long time ago that he was the source. I can only make one major decision a year. So it was 1981 when I decided to go back to school, get another degree. And I visited graduate schools in the hill country of Texas because that's the most beautiful part, and that's where I wanted to live.
And when I talked to the people at the University of Texas in Austin, I realized they had the program I wanted. And I said, you tell me what I need to do, and I'll spend the next year doing it. And they did, and I spent the next year doing all the things I had to do to be accepted into that program. And just about a year ago, in June of 1982, I moved to Austin. It was very difficult to leave the house where my children grew up. It was difficult to leave my comfort zone, the place where I lived for a very long time. And I had long conversations with God about that. And he reminded me that anywhere I live is his house, and that I could take the memories with me, and the house was, after all, only brick and wood. Besides, you had told me a long time before that I was going to be all right. You would laugh to see me on the other side of that desk. I am having a terrible time. I have resisted the impulse to correct the professor's grammar. Not that I don't want to. And I keep wanting to teach the class. Someone will ask a question and the professor won't answer it adequately. And every school teaching cell in my body, you know, wants to say, and furthermore, and then really explain it to them. I knew that I would miss teaching. I would like for you to think I miss it because I miss enlightening the youth of America. What I miss is spending 8 hours a day with people who thought I was rather neat. And instead being really low man on the totem pole, which you are when you're a first-year graduate student. A few years ago, I was listening to a fifth step, and the man who was talking told me that during the years of his wife's drinking, he had been so obsessed with her that he missed the childhood of his daughters. He said, I miss so many present moments. And I liked the term, and I don't want to miss any present moments. Tommy Green up in Winnipeg says the way that you don't miss the present moment is to ask yourself at any given time, how am I conscious of God right now, this minute? Well, right now, this minute, I'm conscious of him because you did what I asked you to. You loved me back while I was talking, and you listened with your heart. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for being who you are and whose you are.